This has been another pandemic week where the question of risk assessment, how we gauge dangers and assess how to respond them, has been very much at the front of mind in Australia and around the world. The UK, of course, had its Freedom Day recently, repealing all its COVID-19 regulations, despite experiencing an average of over 40,000 cases a day. That's the rolling seven-day average in the UK at the moment. Half of the population of Australia is still in lockdown as we go to air today, with the Delta variant of coronavirus seemingly still out of control in New South Wales. So the situation is certainly changing in terms of the risk assessment for vaccines. Here's some of the discussion that was heard on RN Breakfast on Friday, the 23rd of July. He is the National President of the Pharmacy Guild of Australia, Trent Toomey.
And nothing is without risk. Nothing is without risk. This is about having a conversation to get the facts so you can make a decision about what is in the best interest for you personally, for your community, for your loved ones that you're caring for that might not be able to get the vaccine. So AstraZeneca is a very good vaccine.
And then here's Dr. Karen Price, President of the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners.
There's no zero risk here, and it's very, very obvious when I sit down and go through an individual risk-benefit profile with those patients how important it is for over 60s to receive an AstraZeneca vaccine, because that's the one available. We've got plenty of AstraZeneca, over 60s, I can't imagine how afraid I would feel for someone in that age group if there was an outbreak of COVID in their community.
And so on the roundtable today, we're discussing that question of doing that risk assessment, whether it's individually or as a matter of public policy. And of course, the risk assessment has changed because of events in New South Wales. Yesterday, ATAGI, the Australian Technical Advisory Group on Immunisation, updated its advice saying all adult Sydneysiders should strongly consider the AstraZeneca vaccine amid the COVID outbreak in New South Wales. So we're going to have a broad-ranging discussion today about risk assessment and whether we as human beings are any good at it. Joining us for the discussion are Angela Jackson, lead economist at Equity Economics. Welcome, Angela.
Good morning.
Great to have
you. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Angela was previously the Deputy Chief of Staff to Australia's Finance Minister during the GFC. We're also joined by Professor Jason Tangen. Sorry if I've got the pronunciation of your surname incorrect there, Jason, but welcome.
Oh, that's right.
How do we say your surname?
Tangen.
Tangen. Yeah, excellent. And Jason is the Associate Professor of Cognitive Science at the University of Queensland. So welcome to you, Jason. And welcome also Professor Sharon Lewin, Director of the Peter Doherty Institute for Infection and Immunity. Welcome to the roundtable, Sharon.
Morning.
It's great to have all three of you around the roundtable today. As I said, we're going to have a wide-ranging and broad discussion. I'm going to look at this in the wider sense. So, Angela, I thought I'd start by asking you if you could tell us a little bit about your experiences of dealing with risk assessment as an economist, and particularly in that really critical phase of when you were working for Finance Minister Lindsay Tanner, who, of course, was one of the key figures shaping up the Rudd government response to the GFC?
Yeah, look, certainly. And look, thanks for the question. And it's taking us back a long time now, obviously, but probably the last sort of major economic issue facing a government, one of the trickiest, I guess, policy questions that it had to face. So we're obviously facing, you know, uncertain times economically, internationally, and we saw collapses of Lehman Brothers, and we saw, you know, runs on banks internationally. And so in Australia, we really faced a question of, do we go before we see that happen here, or do we wait and see it happen and then respond? And there was a weekend, a critical weekend in that response, where the decisions were made by the, you know, by the government and by the executive, and really led by the Prime Minister, that we had to do everything we could to avoid a recession. And so we had to move first. And so we saw a guarantee on bank deposits announced over the weekend and a huge stimulus package that at the time, you know, was unparalleled. And we hadn't seen any negative real economic impact in Australia yet. So it was preemptive, if you like. We went hard and we went early to ameliorate that risk of that impacting Australia. Now, in hindsight, it was the right decision. It meant that Australia avoided recession, and it meant that, you know, we got out of that situation a lot better than people did internationally, where unemployment went much higher, where there was prolonged economic downturn and, you know, a lot of human impact from that. But they're tough decisions because you're making decisions in a period of uncertainty where you have to weigh up the risks of action, how much action, where does the action need to be, without having the full suite of information that you'd normally have when you're making those decisions. And I guess what I saw during that process, and at the time I was a relatively young advisor, was that it was really, I think, the decision makers' focus on avoiding that bad outcome that drove the decision making, that we needed to avoid recession at all costs, and that had to be the primary focus of the policy response.
That's really interesting, Angela Jackson. Thank you very much. And striking how, although the context was so different and it was facing a financial crisis, how many of those concepts really resonate with things that we're discussing in such an urgent way at the moment. Do we go ahead? Do we act now? Or do we respond? What are the consequences of waiting? Really fascinating parallels. Jason, if I could come to you now, could you give us a bit of an outline of what cognitive science tells us about how human beings undertake the tricky task of assessing risks?
Yeah, it's tricky, as you said. I mean, we often give more weight to ideas that come to mind easily. So you can immediately think of several facts that support a judgment. You might be inclined to think that judgment is correct. So when deciding whether to get the AstraZeneca jab or the jab itself of any sort, then, you know, people are sometimes hesitant because of the incredible amount of media coverage around the risk of blood clots, the personal stories that are presented, and the rare reports from all over the world. And the same goes for reports of vaccine side effects. When you're thinking about whether to get the jab or not, these examples easily flood to mind. But what doesn't flood to mind are the many tens of thousands of people who got the jab without any ill effects whatsoever. Mm. So these examples don't come to mind because we don't hear about them. So when weighing up the risks of the AstraZeneca jab, we just think about the potential side effects of the jab. We don't think about the effects of COVID. I mean, there's a very good chance that all of us will encounter SARS-CoV-2 at some point in the future. But the question is whether you'd be better off confronting it vaccinated or unvaccinated. Tens of millions of people have already participated in this natural experiment around the world, and it's overwhelmingly clear that the folks who are vaccinated are much better off. But it's not easy to think about.
And Jason, can we train ourselves to assess risk better? And if so, how do you do it?
Yeah, not easy. I mean, we have kind of an automatic response when thinking about all of these problems under uncertainty. That is, in the same way that, you know, 2 + 2 = right, the answer immediately pops into mind. That's an automatic sort of response. Mm. But we also have this sort of deliberate sort of tactic as well. You can think analytically. You can kind of weigh things up. We can do long division, right? We have this sort of propensity.
Some of us can. I'm not sure I could these days, but yeah, I know what you're saying.
Right. If you had time and a pencil, you might be able to do it. But we often don't. I mean, it's hard to do, and it's effortful, and so it's a lot easier to kind of slip into these sort of automatic processes. But we don't need to.
Fascinating. Thanks very much, Jason, and Jason's Associate Professor of Cognitive Science at the University of Queensland. Professor Sharon Lewin, so far I suppose we've talked about two aspects of risk, dealing with it as a matter of national economic policy and then also the sort of the psychology of individual risk assessment. Could you tell us how the question of risk assessment is viewed in the field of infectious diseases?
Yeah, thanks, Julian. Look, I think there's two aspects to this. There's first of all, personal risk, which I deal with on a day-to-day basis as a clinician. Mm. So when you have someone sitting in front of you, every time you're recommending a form of treatment, you're doing a risk-benefit analysis with that person. And then for public health, you do a risk-benefit for the population, and that includes both the personal risk-benefit for each individual, each Australian, and then the benefits we get as a population, and that has to be weighed against reality, you know, what's available, you know, where we always have limits on availability, whether it's because of actual access to a particular treatment or here being a vaccine, or whether there's limits to relative amounts of that vaccine, so you need to spread it across the population. So there's two levels at which you, so there's the individual risk and there's the population risk, which I've kind of had a bit of experience with. And I think what's very different in this setting right now where we are in with COVID, AstraZeneca and Pfizer, is that the individual was getting information from a vast array of sources, and that adds a whole layer of complexity because they're getting it from mainstream media where you're hearing diverse news, journalists giving opinion, so-called experts giving an opinion, the population having no idea who's really an expert. They just hear Dr. something giving an opinion. Then they've got social media, then they've got friends and family. And so suddenly that decision-making, which people make every single time they go and see a doctor, becomes very, very complicated and quite skewed. And I think that's what we're seeing now with COVID, much, much more challenging.
Yes, and I was going to ask you whether COVID-19 in particular has changed anything in your view about the risk assessment of infectious diseases. But from what you've said, it sounds like I should ask whether it's the disease or the technological and media context which has changed things.
Oh, it hasn't changed my view of how we make judgments at all. It's changed my view on how we communicate them. And in a very different world, and in a world where every single person is affected by this, so everyone has a view. And managing that messaging becomes just so much more complex. But, you know, in some parts of the world, that messaging has been rolled out with very different impacts to what we have in Australia. So just look at the UK, where they've also had AstraZeneca and Pfizer, identical choice of vaccine. Very different, of course, clinical setting, because they've had lot of infection, a lot of deaths. But the whole perception of AstraZeneca totally different in a country like UK compared to Australia.
Yeah, really fascinating. I'll come back to you, Angela Jackson, because obviously one of the key themes that's emerging is the communication around risk assessment. And I wonder if that's something that hopefully doesn't trigger too much post-traumatic stress for you about the GFC, but no. In terms of how much of a discussion that was, there's maybe the sort of the pure economist's view of what the best thing to do is, but then also how to communicate that, because certainly I recall the political discussion and one of the challenges for the Labor government being that it's very hard to convince people after the fact that dramatic action prevented something worse because we didn't experience the worst outcome.
Yeah, look, that's right, because I think what happens is, you know, is it seen as a gain or as a loss, if you like? And so, you know, if the economy is already doing badly and you spend money, then effectively it's a gain. But if the economy just keeps doing well and you've just spent money, then it can be seen as a loss. And the way in which we see those things is very different, which I think comes to the vaccine issue about whether or not getting the AstraZeneca and the risks associated with that versus other vaccines is seen as a gain or as a loss. And that comes down to the messaging. At the moment, unfortunately, in Australia, I think too much of it sees that that it's a potential loss rather than seeing it as the gain that it is for the individual in terms of reducing the risk of COVID and reducing the risk across the community of COVID. So that perception of risk and the perception of gains is really important in terms of the communication. And it's difficult, yes, from a policy perspective, if, for example, with lockdowns, if you've just avoided a catastrophic outcome, then the perception can be that you've done something that wasn't necessary and you don't necessarily get the benefits of that politically.
Thanks very much, Angela. Jason Tangen, if I could come to you. How good are we at, as humans, at assessing the value of a worse outcome avoided?
Of a worse outcome avoided. Yeah, that's tricky. As Angela was saying, in terms of losses and gains, I mean, that's kind of bedrock psychology from the 70s in terms of loss aversion. Humans are really loss averse, right? And particularly when you're thinking about the Astra vaccine, the Astra jab, we don't want to. We tend to think about what we have to lose by getting the vaccine as opposed to what we have to gain by doing it. So, I mean, instead of kind of dwelling on the side effects, you can think about, I mean, in terms of communication, I think it's really useful to think less about me and more about we, as some of my colleagues at UQ have to say. I mean, this is a global problem. It's bigger than us. It's bigger than our state. It's bigger than the country. I mean, we need to think about these things globally. It's a social issue. And so when framing these problems, all of these sort of issues that we've just faced, even yesterday with the anti-vaxxer protests, it's particularly dominated by people who are thinking about themselves, who are thinking about what they have to lose, what the costs are to their freedom, as opposed to what we stand to gain by engaging in these sort of pro-social behaviors. So I think it's really, really more of a we problem than a me thing.
Jason, a lot of the time, attempts to sort of rationalize risk analysis and to communicate those assessments is done by, comparing risks in terms of the 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 1,000,000 different sort of numbers. How compelling are numerical comparisons to human minds?
Yeah, this is some of the research that we've done, mainly in jury decision making and other areas, and medical decision making and so on. And, I mean, people are terrible at reasoning about probabilities more generally. I mean, the extent to which you can frame them in terms of natural frequencies, I mean, the better. So particularly when you deal with numbers like 1 in 1,000,000 or 1 in 1,000,000,000 sort of chances, things get a little bit murky. I mean, humans are really good at thinking about, on the order of hundreds, maybe thousands. But when you use higher numbers than that, it just kind of loses all meaning. And so there are ways of kind of representing these problems a little bit better, which has been done quite well in medical decision making, using diagrams and so on to try to communicate risk, communicate uncertainty a little bit, to try to weigh up various options and choosing one treatment over another. And I think they could learn a lot in kind of public health about ways to communicate the risk of COVID versus various treatments versus comparatively.
On Sunday Extra and on The Roundtable, we're discussing risk assessment in a time of pandemic with Angela Jackson, lead economist at Equity Economics, Associate Professor Jason Tangen from the Cognitive Science, from the University of Queensland, and Jason's an Associate Professor in Cognitive Science, and Professor Sharon Lewin, Director of the Peter Doherty Institute. And I'd like to come to you now, Professor Lewin. I wonder how much training there is for medical professionals in terms of that question of communicating risk as well as assessing it, and what your experience as a clinician has been in terms of what works for trying to help your patients to assess risk in a way that you think is sort of consistent with their best interests.
Yeah, I think we get a lot of training in communicating risk because you really are doing it every day as a practitioner. What medical practitioners don't get training about is communicating or understanding population risk.
Yes.
And decisions for populations based on, dollars, resources, availability. And so if I could just get back to this issue again about where people are getting their information from. We have Dr. XYZ on our radios and TV screens every night. They may be infectious diseases specialists, but they probably have absolutely no experience in making decisions for populations. So most clinicians will think about the patient in front of them, which is fantastic for our patients. Our doctors have your best interest in mind, and they're very used to making that going through, it's really standard stuff, going through it with the person sitting in front of you. What's very different is when you think about populations and how you spread an intervention like a vaccine across a population and the overall benefit. And I actually think, and I'm a clinician myself, I actually think clinicians are not very good at that because they don't make those decisions. They sometimes do because within a hospital, for example, you do have limited resources. So you also are you're also juggling this issue of resource and availability with decision making. But most clinicians have zero experience in deciding at a population level. And that's where I think we're getting this very confusing message happening. My personal experience with going through this with patients is that, you know, most people deal with this really well, and they do need to have the information presented in some curated or nuanced way, and that's your role as a clinician. If you get a take an antibiotic and you open up the box and look at what that antibiotic could do to you.
Well, you wouldn't take anything, would you? If you actually read the full fine print, you'd be terrified.
Exactly. You just don't have it. No one has the tools to digest that or make sense of it. And it's the same thing when you go online and try and get your information from the internet. What you rely on with a health practitioner, not necessarily a doctor, a nurse, or whoever the practitioner is, pharmacist, is they're digesting it for you. And so when you're starting a new medication, there's a ton of things that could happen, but you just deal with the most common ones and the ones that they really need to know about in case, you know, because you're going to make adjustments based on those adverse events. So your messaging has to be, you know, set in reality and just, you know, the most important messages communicated. You cannot go through that whole list. And most people are able to make those decisions very well. Of course, you get some people that will just say, whatever you think, doctor, and others that will want to ask a lot of questions, do some research themselves and have a more prolonged discussion. So that spectrum is quite normal. I think the challenge that all of us face right now is looking at when you make it the population at a population level. And just to get back to the messaging around which I loved that expression from Jason before on the we, not me. You know, the AstraZeneca gives unbelievable benefit to the individual. Unbelievably good benefit. It's a great vaccine. It prevents your hospitalization by over 95% after your second vaccine, and over 60% protection if it's Delta for just getting infected. So and a reduction in transmission by 50%. Huge personal benefit. Huge community benefit. And then we've sort of stuck in this issue around most people just hear the word AstraZeneca, they hear blood clot second rate vaccine. We just have to find a way to change the narrative. There's no doubt that with more COVID in the community, the discussion becomes very different. And I think we will see a difference now with the outbreak in Sydney and people's uptake of AstraZeneca, but it might be too late. I think the damage may well have all been done.
It's really fascinating. Thanks very much, Sharon. I want to pick up on one of the things that you talked about there in terms of focusing the message and perhaps contrast that with another theme that Angela spoke about initially, which is the challenge of confronting uncertainty. And so, Angela Jackson, I wanted to ask you about your thoughts on communicating risk, and in particular this question of how we confront uncertainty and whether it's valuable at all to be open and frank if you're in a position of authority about the fact that you don't necessarily know what's going to work.
Look, I think honesty is important. So it's a fine balancing act between, you know, people need to have trust in the health information that they're getting. So if there's a view out there that people haven't been transparent, then that might diminish trust. But I think it is around how we present the information and what we call for. So, you know, in Australia, really, we haven't had the counter information out there around AstraZeneca. We haven't had the information for the public to make an informed choice. So a lot of people have been basing it off media reports where people can be very selective about the information they choose to hear. It can confirm pre-existing biases, for example. Yeah. And then people obviously on Facebook where, you know, we have a new source of information that is very unregulated and quite, I guess, disruptive in terms of government's overall communicating messages. So what we probably need in Australia, and I don't think we should give up on AstraZeneca, and I don't think we should give up particularly, you know, it's going to be important for over 60s, particularly in Sydney, because there won't be enough Pfizer in the intervening period, is we do need a campaign that outlines, you know, the benefits of the vaccine, that makes it really clear that, you know, you can reduce, if you're an 80-year-old, your risk of dying from this disease to that of a 50-year-old. And that's a huge gain for our older cohorts. And so it's really about getting that information out there, and we haven't really seen that yet. And so it's difficult, I think, when we say we versus me, when we haven't given the population and certain segments of the population in particular, I'm talking non-English speaking background people in particular, we haven't even given them the opportunity of the information that they need yet. And that's really been, I think, the thing lacking. So in terms of communication, you know, it's important that it's in language people can understand. It's important that it is honest, and it's important that it is communicated by trusted sources such as government, which we, again, we just haven't seen.
Thanks very much, Angela. Jason Tangen, what are your thoughts on, from a cognitive science perspective, on embracing or being frank about uncertainty and the psychological significance of authority in our decision-making?
I think, there's exactly as you said. I mean, it, particularly in psychology at the moment, we're facing this sort of issue of openness and transparency. And I think that's right across science, really, is how do you make the findings from science more available, more open, and more transparent for everybody to see exactly. I mean, I think a lot of people, when thinking about whether to get the Astra jab or in communicating the risk and so on, a lot of people feel like there's something hidden, right? They're not being told the whole story. But in fact, if you just kind of open your books, open your lab notes, make everything available for people to see, I think it just makes it really obvious that the scientists who are involved in this process have no vested interest. They're not trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes. And I think we need, as scientists, to communicate this better to everybody and kind of show our work and make it there's nothing to fear here. And instead of dwelling on the influence and actions of in terms of communication, of hardcore anti-vaxxers, which is the far end of the spectrum, I think it's going to be a lot more useful to think about people who are generally keen to get the vaccine. And I think that's the majority of people.
Interesting.
But their intention is to do so might be impeded by some practical barriers. And it's worth focusing on those. It's critical to understand what these barriers are, particularly among the more hesitant group, and address them. For example, we need to make it easy for people to book an appointment and a time slot of their choice, make it easy for them to get to the vaccination site, address any potential barriers in getting there. And I think the extent to which we can focus on that going to be really have an effect on the uptake.
Yeah, that sounds like it's sort of going into that area of nudging and sort of how to make pathways easier for people. Look, unfortunately, we're running out of time. We're coming up to the 10 o'clock news, so we're going to have to wrap things up there. But thanks very much to everyone for being part of the roundtable discussion today. Sharon Lewin, thanks very much for your valuable public advocacy, as always.
Pleasure. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
It's been great having you. Sharon Lewin's the director of the Peter Doherty Institute for Infection and Immunity. Thanks to you also, Jason Tangen.
Yep, thank you.
Jason's Associate Professor of Cognitive Science at the University of Queensland. And Angela Jackson, thanks very much for being part of the roundtable.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Angela's the lead economist at Equity Economics.